Well, here's something to chew on. Between 1999 and 2004, the number of U.S. households experiencing hunger increased 43%, with the prevalence of food insecurity among Californians exceeding the national average. This leads one to ask, who's hungry now?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 497th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're streaming along with our friends over there in Frankfurt who pick us up on the internet at www.metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Jay Cruz on the boards. Hello, Jay.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, folks, we are broadcasting today from the Monterey Bay area, which is the salad bowl of the world. So imagine my surprise when I read a study that said that the number of people who go an entire day without food here in the salad bowl of the world has tripled in the past 5 years. This leads me to ask, who is hungry now? And what better time to ask than National Hunger Awareness Day, which is this coming Monday. And who better to ask than the people from the Second Harvest Food Bank? And here we have three of them with us today. So we're going to learn a lot about who's hungry now and why they're hungry and what we could possibly do about it. And we have Willie Elliott McCray. Willie, you're the executive director of the Santa Cruz and San Benito County Second Harvest Food Banks, correct?
Correct. Absolutely. Good to be here.
Good. Let me make sure I have that mic on. Go ahead and say hello again one more time.
Good morning. Hello. Glad to be here.
I'm not sure that's on. Okay, now we got it. There we go. I fixed you, Willie.
Oh, good.
Okay. And also Lee Mercer, who's the Education and Outreach Director for the same Second Harvest Food Bank. Lee, welcome aboard.
Good morning.
And also we have with us from Chicago, Doug O'Brien, who is the Vice President of Public Policy for America's Second Harvest Food Bank. Doug, thank you for joining us from Chicago today.
Well, it's my pleasure. Good morning.
So, gentlemen, welcome to the food bank. How does the Second Harvest work? Let's start with the local and work our way to the national. Willie, how does the Second Harvest Food Bank work?
Well, how the Second Harvest Food Bank works is we collect food from local growers and farmers and shippers, manufacturers, retailers, food from U.S. Department of Agriculture and local food drives.
That's the Second Harvest, right?
The Second Harvest, yes. Second Harvest collects. And this year, will have brought in 5.5 million pounds of food, $8 million worth of food that we'll distribute to 160 local agencies and programs throughout Santa Cruz, San Benito, North Monterey County.
So, to paraphrase, I guess you kind of like a gleaner hub, right?
You glean
food from the food chain, and you bring it into this central facility called Second Harvest Food Bank, and then you distribute it to how many different agencies?
So like you said, we're the link, bringing the food all together and distribute it out to 160 agencies and programs. And those agencies and programs are feeding about 44,000 people on average a month in this local area.
Wow. Lee Mercer, how many of these local Second Harvest food banks are there?
In the nation, there's over 200 food banks around the nation serving tens of thousands of agencies around the country.
And tens of thousands of agencies are serving
25 million people.
25 million people?
Yeah, over, and Doug has this better, but probably over 6 billion, or no, 2 billion pounds of food this year.
Doug?
Well, Lee's absolutely correct. It's 50,000. Local agencies and communities all across the country that are part of the Second Harvest Network through the food banks, as Willie was describing earlier. And on any given week in the United States, 4.5 million people are accessing services at one of those agencies through the food bank.
Wow. How did Second Harvest Food Bank come into being, and how old is it?
Well,
an incredible, huge organization. Where did it come from?
It's amazing. Like you said, you know, there's, when you think about a million volunteers across the country is part of this. And you know, to me, You know, it started in 1967 in St. Mary's Food Bank in Arizona. Our food bank here in Santa Cruz County is the second oldest food bank in the country, 1972, oldest in California. And like you said, looking at that and then...
So we're 34, 35 years old then.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And it's spread across the country in that amount of time?
Right, right, to over 200 food banks. And, you know, earlier we were just chatting a little bit and you asked, well, where did America's Second Harvest come from? And you know, one of the interesting things is 1979, you know, one of our founding directors, Michael Alexander, got together with 12 other food banks across the country, Atlanta, New York City, San Jose, and they put together and they organized the America's Second Harvest as a national network of food banks. Originally it was in Phoenix, Arizona, and then we moved it to Chicago to be in the heartland.
Well, one question we always ask our guests and from wherever they come, we want to know who pays your way.
So, good question. And, you know, it's one of the things that I love. Just this community that we live in is extremely generous community. 75% of all our support is private support. One of the things I'm particularly proud of, when I started working there in 1988, and at that point, 75% of our funding was government funding. And, you know, so who pays our way is we have 4,000 people that send us checks for under $100 every year. And another, you know, 3,000 people that send us larger checks. You know, it truly is a grassroots organization. It's got an incredible breadth of support. It's you know, it's the widow's mite that's really making sure that other folks don't have to go through some of the struggles that they've had to go through.
Doug, do you see that same pattern of giving across the country?
Yes, absolutely. Willie's right. A very small percentage, even through food banks all across the country, rely on government support. It's almost entirely the work of local communities trying to address this problem through the food bank.
To what do you attribute the incredible growth of the food bank in 35 years? That's a relatively short amount of time. And how many thousands of people are connected with the food banks around the country, Doug?
Well, we have more than a million volunteers that rely. A million volunteers, and what's interesting is we've done independent research has been conducted for us, and these volunteers donate on average 53 hours a year, which is, you put it contextually, that's a full work week plus overtime to help people in their communities. And many of these volunteers are just like any of the rest of us; they're very busy, they have lives, kids, grandkids, and they somehow make the time to help address this issue in their community by volunteering, donating food, and as Billy mentioned, you know, sending money to help keep the lights on and the trucks moving.
So, what do you attribute this incredible growth? You know, from 35 years ago, 1972, there was a couple of food pantries that got together, God, how did you guys grow this incredible organization in such a short period of time? I mean, you've got millions of people working with you. I mean, that's one heck of an army.
Yeah, it is. You know, I think it's one, it's a testament to the American culture, which is that we are a people, even as new people come in and become American, there's this notion of volunteerism and giving back that is something very special. In addition, we have a very large and broad-based faith community that helps support this. About three quarters nationally of all the pantries and soup kitchens around the country are affiliated with some faith organization or another. So one hand, it's I think there's a willingness of people to want to help, and then secondly, the problem's been growing, and that's been, as you started the show with, it's a problem that has not abated. So we've come close to making real success. Macroeconomic conditions and just a change generally in the employment status and nature of this country has made it more difficult for us to make the progress I think many of us like us to have in our community.
Well, that's brings us to the hunger study. Lee Mercer, tell us about this study that fell into my lap and blew my head away.
Well, we were just a part of the National Hunger Study. The National Hunger Study interviewed 52,000 people in over 150 served by 150 food banks around the country. Locally, we interviewed about 300 clients of soup kitchens, shelters, and pantries, and learned about the demographics of hunger in our area. And essentially, we just learned that hunger is growing in our area, and that, for example, that 70% of the people we serve are under the poverty level, that a third of who we serve have incomes under $500 a month. People are living, as you know, what the costs are out here on the Central Coast for housing. People are it's almost impossible to get by in this area to live if you've got a low-income situation.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here in a minute, but when we come back, we want to ask you out there. The number of people, number of hungry among us appears to be increasing every year. Who are these people? And do you see them? Love to hear about it. And furthermore, what do you think we should do about it? As you know, the food chain is media that talks with you and not at you, so pick up your phone and join us today. We've got the folks from Second Harvest Food Bank, and they know about hungry because they feed the hungry, lots and lots and lots of hungry. When we come back, we're going to find out, we'll put a face on that hunger and ask who those people are and how they came to be hungry and what we can do about it. So join us. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We've got Willie Elliott McCray, Lee Mercer, and Doug O'Brien from Second Harvest Food Bank. And you do stay tuned. Hey, welcome back out there. This is The Food Chain. Today we're coming to you from the salad bowl of the world, the Monterey Bay Area. We grow so much food here, it's just amazing to know that there is possibly be hunger in a place where so much food is grown, and yet that is the case. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. We've got Willie Elliott McCray, we have Lee Mercer, we have Doug O'Brien from America's Second Harvest Food Bank Network, a network of how many food banks around the country?
Over 200 food banks.
Over 200, and they serve over how many different agencies, Doug O'Brien?
50,000.
50,000, and they feed a lot of hungry people. So we look at a place where so much food is grown, and we note this hunger study says that there are a lot of hungry people here. Who are they, Lee Mercer? Who's hungry now?
Well, the majority of who we serve at our food bank are working families, children, seniors, and the disabled. 40% of the people we serve are children. And UCLA did a recent study a year or so ago, and they geomapped California, and the intense areas of hunger are in the areas where the food is grown, up the Central Valley, into the Salinas Valley, into the Pajaro Valley, in the rural areas of California. And I think, Doug, the rural areas all around the country are showing areas of extreme hunger.
Doug?
Yeah, that's correct. In fact, if you look at USDA's most recent study, you'll find that the highest rates of food insecurity and hunger around the country are consistently in areas both out west and in the rural south.
Why?
Well, I think lots of reasons, not least of which is that there's not a lot of jobs. And the jobs that do exist in many of these communities are don't pay adequately. I think Lee or Willie made that point earlier about the high cost of living. In California, one of the things we've asked people in our study are some of the challenges that they face that force them to come to food banks or food bank agencies for food assistance. And what we find is that better than a third, in most cases, have to choose between buying food and paying their rent or buying food and paying for medical care or buying food and paying gas or utility bills. And as such, you know, we've put a lot of Americans, in this case 25 million, in a very difficult situation where they have to turn to charity simply to, you know, provide for one of life's most basic necessities.
Mm-hmm. So we see hunger where food is grown. What about cities, Lee?
Well, the urban areas, of course, and again, we're not as urban an area. We're more of a suburban and agricultural area. And we have the worst of both worlds in some ways, in the sense that we have a lot of people struggling to get along and a lot of agricultural workers, but rents going through the ceiling. But obviously, if you're living in San Francisco or New York with the rents and the cost of housing the way they are, it's a struggle to survive there, too.
I guess you see a lot of that, Doug, around the country. What about the metropolitan, the urban areas and hunger there? Who's hungry there?
Yeah, typically in central cities, the food insecurity rates or hunger rates, and certainly the rates of people requesting emergency food through our network, are generally high. And about 57% of the people we serve reside in central cities. The problem, though, is that 43% reside in suburban or rural areas. like the area that, that Willie and Lee are referring. It's pretty much everywhere. And to Lee's point, it's pretty much consistently the same group of people, working poor families, children, and disabled and elderly people. And, you know, essentially our society's most vulnerable that really have not been able to recover when the economy recovered and are slow to get back on their feet when something goes wrong in their life.
So we talk about the working poor. Who are the working poor? What does that mean? I mean, Lee?
In our area, strongly, people working in agriculture, working in hospitality industry, working service jobs that don't pay hourly rates that it probably costs $18 an hour to live in this area minimally, with two people working in a family and a minimum wage job. California, $6.75 is the work or the minimum wage at this point.
Yeah, often part-time and seasonal. Yeah. And, you know, and the thing that I worry about is there again the kids of those families, you know, because, you know, two-thirds of the families that are living in poverty with kids, you know, have someone who's working in the household. So, you know, it's work is no longer a guarantee to be able to support your kids to success. You know, I mean, here again, you know, 40% of who we're serving locally and as well as nationally are kids. I mean, it makes me, it scares me for our future. You know, you have thousands of kids locally, millions of kids nationally that are malnourished. Their brains aren't properly developing. They can't concentrate in school. You're setting them up for failure. You're creating another generation.
Cruising for a bruising, right?
Right. You're setting up a cycle of poverty.
One thing we were talking about earlier is that hunger is kind of hard to see driving down the street, is it not, Lee?
Yeah, a lot of the people we serve, and we do, a percentage, and there's a growing percentage of those who we serve on the Central Coast who are homeless. There's over 3,000 people in our county here, Santa Cruz County, that are homeless. But unlike the Depression, when you had the Hoovervilles at the side of the road with the migrant workers from the central part of the countries, the people that are homeless now are in the levees and in, out in the bush and out in the forest, and you don't see the homeless in our county, but they're here. And there people were serving through soup kitchens and shelters.
What about the suburbs? Does hunger exist in the suburbs? Doug?
Yes, actually, yeah. In fact, the rates of poverty and food insecurity are growing in suburbs at a much faster rate than the population is increasing in those communities. It's not surprising, really, and I don't know if it's true in so much in California as in other parts of the country, that there was an explosive growth of housing and jobs and many low-income families wanting to get, you know, better education for the children and more secure employment moved out to the suburbs and then only found themselves caught in essentially a cycle of need. And so we're finding this across the country, the collar counties of Chicago, New York. This is particularly pronounced.
Lee, we live in one of the least affordable places in the world here in the Monterey Bay Area. The cost of housing is just through the roof, and as you said, the jobs aren't paying that much. Is poverty restricted to the poorer neighborhoods?
Well, that's the amazing.
Is hunger restricted?
My department of the food bank, we have the community food hotline. We take incoming calls 5 days a week from people that are hungry and need food. And those calls are coming from surprising neighborhoods, Golf Club Drive in Aptos, Scotts Valley. These are affluent neighborhoods. If you're working in Silicon Valley, if you lose your job, if you have a huge mortgage on a house in an affluent neighborhood, all of a sudden you have no resources to even pay the basic necessities of life. So it permeates the area.
It's amazing all the things that just kick you into, you know, you're doing fine one day and the next day you're not. I mean, it could be credit card hell. It could be your spouse walking out. It could be a medical emergency. It could be a whole lot of things, having to quit your job to take care for a dying parent. You know, and these things are kicking people in, you know, to just not being able, like Lee said, to pay their mortgage and to be able to put any food on the table for themselves or their kids.
There, but for the grace of God, go we, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about hunger with people who know hunger because they feed the hungry all across the land. Willie Elliott McCray, Executive Director of the Second Harvest Food Bank here in Santa Cruz and San Benito counties in California. Lee Mercer, who is Education and Outreach Director here in California as well. And Doug O'Brien, who's the Vice President of Public Policy at America's Second Harvest Food Bank in Chicago. Once again, there are how many Second Harvest food banks?
Over 200.
Over 200.
In the country.
And Doug, how many agencies are they serving?
50,000.
And how many people are fed from the Second Harvest Food Bank?
25.3 million.
25.3 million hungry people in this country. So I'm going to lay a real interesting question on the table for when we get back, and that is, why should we feed the hungry? I'm curious to hear what you have to think out there. The question, why should we feed the hungry? The phone number is 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Please do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking hunger in America with the people who feed the hungry in America, Second Harvest Food Bank. We have Willie Elliott McCray, Lee Mercer, and Doug O'Brien. Willie and Lee are from Santa Cruz, San Benito counties here. The salad bowl of the world, and yet, though we grow so much food here, there are hungry here. And it's kind of hard to see why there would be so much food and so much hunger. And we're going to go to the phones right now. Maybe we have a caller here who will help us start off this discussion. We have Margaret. And folks, the phone number is, if you'd care to participate, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Let's go to Margaret. Margaret, welcome to The Food Chain.
Good morning. Great show as always.
Thank you.
Yes. I find that the soup kitchens, more so the Second Harvest pantries, really are serving the majority in Santa Cruz County are illegal aliens.
So
I just see
when you say the soup kitchens, these are the agencies, I guess, that the Second Harvest provides food to,
like Loaves and Fishes, like, or St. Francis Soup Kitchen, et cetera, right?
Actually, not the soup kitchens so much. The soup kitchens are pretty much the local poor, but the church-based pantries and the Second Harvest pantries for Thanksgiving, Christmas, stuff like that. I mean, it's just inundated with throngs of illegal aliens.
Okay. Well, there you are. Illegal aliens.
I think they really burden our food bank system. Mm-hmm.
Well, this kind of goes back to Michael's questions about why feed the hungry people.
Yeah.
One of the imperatives...
Isn't that what you're asking, Margaret? Why should we feed the illegal immigrants?
Well,
isn't that the core of what you're saying?
I mean, if they want to nab illegal aliens, just go to the food lines, take them away. You know, really, and they burden our systems so much. And most of them look like they could stand to lose about 60 pounds.
Oh, that's another good question. How can hungry people be overweight?
And this is turning into a more complicated question, but in actuality, the majority of the people we serve are either local or legal immigrants. But we don't ask. All the pantries that serve food from Second Harvest don't ask, because basically, getting back to your question earlier, Michael, of why feed the poor and why feed the hungry, all the major religions have an imperative, and it's a moral imperative in every religion in the world that you feed the hungry. And Jesus nor any of the other religious leaders said feed only the legal immigrants, or so we're basically, there's a moral imperative to do so. But if we close the borders tomorrow and someone had to pick the fields and someone had to do the low wage jobs, we'd be feeding somebody, because there's something systemically wrong with the system right now if people can work a 40-hour week and not be able to feed their family.
Right, and what can you do about the people that really do need to be fed but have like an ego, a pride about actually going in and asking for help? I see that.
Yeah, it's one of the hardest issues because, you know, there's so much pride. I find, you know, like Lee said with the hotline, you know, usually when people call, they're so chagrined. It's really hard to get people to call, and you know, we just say, you know, you're working hard, you're doing your best you can, but you got to make sure your kids are fed, because if your kids aren't fed, they're not going to do well in school, and they're not going to grow up, and they're not going to be successful. They're going to be just, you know, continuing this whole cycle of poverty. How do we turn this situation around? So, but you're right, you know, and I just see just a tremendous hard work ethic and amount of pride, you know, throughout Santa Cruz County. You know, especially, you know, in a farming community like Watsonville, you just see that huge amount of pride.
Well, Doug, on a national scale, do you see or do you think that illegal immigration has had an impact on these hunger numbers, on the increase in hunger in the United States?
You know, actually, it's interesting. We did study this as part of our 4-year independent study of our system. And less than 9% of all of the people that receive emergency food are either legal or illegal immigrants.
But then you don't ask. So how?
No, they are asked, actually. They are
in your survey,
in the 4-year hunger study.
People, right, 72,000 people are sampled. 52,000 provide information, and it is asked for the purposes of the study.
And like they're really going to tell the truth.
Well, you know. However, I need to say, though, too, I mean, there's a consistency of logic here, though, is that most of the people that do come into this country illegally are coming for work. So they are, in many cases, going to be employed and will only rely on our system when their employment is not sufficient to meet their needs.
And unless, of course, they take jobs that don't pay them enough to support their family, to pay the rent, to pay the medical bills, to pay the everything else, the food, buy food. If they're not making enough in low-paying jobs to provide for themselves, where does that leave us?
Right, but I mean, in addition to the immigration status, clearly not all legal immigrants in this country are Latino or Hispanic. But again, Hispanics constitute about 17% nationally of all the people we serve. And when the outside researchers looked at the raw data, there seems to be the view that it's because many of the immigrants that come to this country legally or illegally come because of employment. And so they are...
Well, and you're absolutely right. And I think it's also true what Margaret said here locally, Doug. You know, I mean, take Pajaro Valley. You know, you got 75,000 people living there. It takes 25,000 people to pick the strawberries and the berries and the crops and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's this work is very, very labor intensive, you know. And so while the percentage may be 9% nationally, it's probably, as Margaret, you know, says, it's probably a little bit higher locally here. But then you have the problem, like you said, what do you do when people are, you know, seasonal work, when they're out of work, you know, and what do you do about, you know, the issue of, you mentioned the issue of overweight, Margaret, and I'm glad you did, because it's one of my favorite issues. You know, one of the things, you know, we were talking earlier, talk about cheap food, you know, it's just like they don't have enough to properly feed, and so, you know, kids are fed with cheap food where it's high in fat, high in sugar. You know, we need to be providing healthy food for these families. You know, we need to be providing, you know, and it's one thing that we really work hard on at Second Harvest locally here is making sure that we're getting fresh fruits and vegetables out to these families. It's very expensive. They pick it, but they can't afford to buy it. But, you know, if you're going to try to do something about the $28 billion we spend in California on obesity issues, you got to make sure that you're providing fresh fruits and vegetables. That's how you fight cancer. That's how you fight diabetes. That's how you fight obesity, heart tension, you know. We're not only about feeding people, but feeding people well with good food.
Margaret, let me ask you, hon, do you work at Feeding the Homeless? You speak like you've been there.
Yes.
Do you think we should be feeding the hungry, and why?
Well, I take it from the fundamental spiritual principles of my Catholicism.
Because the good Lord tells us to feed the hungry,
correct.
Right?
Correct.
Okay, good. Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking hunger. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Why should we feed the hungry?
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Hey, welcome back. Hunger is the subject. There are so many hungry. How many hungry are there? Let's ask the Second Harvest Food Bank. We'll ask Doug O'Brien, who's the Vice President of Public Policy for America's Second Harvest Food Bank in Chicago. Doug, how many hungry are there that you're feeding?
25.3 million Americans being served by our system.
25.3 million people being fed by Second Harvest. Ooh, that's a lot of hungry. Before we went to the break, Margaret gave us one reason why we should feed the hungry, which is to say the good Lord tells us to, whichever faith you happen to practice, or if, even if you don't practice any at all, you feed the hungry because the hungry need to be fed. Any other reasons, Willie Elliott McRae?
I think it makes just basic good economics. If you feed the hungry, what you're doing is you're empowering the future workforce to have the skills that are needed by the business community so we can have a strong economy.
What happens if we don't?
What happens if we don't is we've got, you know, the prisons are full and we don't have people that can do the, you know, the more intellectual, educated jobs that are needed, and the economy suffers and employers move away, and you have a weak economy and you have a cycle of poverty all over again.
Lee?
I have to agree, and I wanted to get back to Margaret's point about the obesity issue. I talked earlier about the geomapping of California.
Right.
The same areas throughout California, the Central Valley and so forth, that are the highest hunger areas are also the highest death by diabetes areas. And as an addition to our hunger study locally, we interviewed and did some nutrition questions, and one of four people interviewed had someone in their household who was diabetic among the people we serve. So diabetes is like an epidemic among the people we serve.
And, of course, since we're feeding these people, I'm sure that we're probably medicating them as well, too, right?
Well, it's costing.
We must be getting health care somewhere.
Yeah.
We're spending $28 billion in California alone on obesity-related health issues, and poor nutrition is fundamental to it. You know,
Doug O'Brien, do you see that across the country, the obesity and the diabetes?
We haven't measured it across the country in that way, but it, you know, clearly other media reports suggest that this, you know, we have an obesity problem in this country. Diabetes remains a problem in this country, and it's why our food banks are generally, you know, fresh produce is now our number one product category, and there's a strong desire to make sure that we have the healthiest foods available in our food banks for people who typically can't afford them through normal outlets.
Good food makes good people. Let's go to
and cheap food is very expensive.
And very expensive. Let's go to Alice, who has worked in some food pantries and has a question and a comment with respect to the kinds of people she sees there. Alice, welcome to The Food Chain.
Hi. Nice to talk to you guys this morning. Well, I worked in one food pantry, and I cooked for the food pantry for a lunchtime meal. And I found that when I prepared the lunches, I always had the base amount of 25 to prepare for, because we had the what I call the derelicts, which are the guys that are on drugs or alcohol, and then we had the people that were mentally impaired that came for their lunchtime meal. Now, they all receive monies to, you know, most of them are on Social Security or SSI or whatever, but they tend to use their monies for other things, mm-hmm. and they're included in your figures. Now, the people that we saw that came in, a lot of them were really good at, you know, taking what we gave to them, but a lot of people would, you know, like if we had vegetables sometimes, they didn't like spinach, or they didn't like broccoli, or they didn't like this, and they didn't want to take them. And at one point, we tried to do a training on having these people come in and learn how to cook healthy meals and what was good for them. But lots of times, they wouldn't take the food because they said they wouldn't use it.
Yeah. So what do you do about them?
Yeah, what do you do?
All right. Thank you for the call. And let's ask Willie, what do you do about them? How do you train them?
You know, we have Lee's got a very good outreach worker, and we do a lot of nutrition education. But like you said, you know, you've got a very strong core of people that have severe alcohol and mental illness issues, you know, in this country and in this community. And, you know, the question is, and as we know, a lot of the state hospitals were closed down many years ago, and a lot of those folks moved out into the streets. And how do we deal with that as a community? You know, I mean, we can let them starve. You know, there are some programs that do an excellent job of providing counseling and the mental health services that are needed to break the cycles of addiction. You know, locally here, we've got the Homeless Resource Center that's got a good counseling program, and Community Counseling Center's got a variety of programs.
So all we can do is the best we can do, right? And what else can we do? I guess there will always be those people, and they will always be a problem. Let's look to the future. What can we do? Lee, start with you.
Yeah, and earlier you asked why is hunger on the rise, and this will kind of get into Doug's bailiwick, but back in 97 with welfare reform, which did improve welfare in a lot of ways in the sense that it created more welfare-to-work type programs, one of the big negatives that occurred was a huge drop in the participation in the food stamp program in this country, which is a very productive program in that it benefits farmers, it benefits the food industry, and it benefits hungry people. There was a huge drop in the participation in the food stamp program due to increased regulation, but also because people coming off of welfare didn't realize they were still eligible for food stamps. So we've been struggling in the food banks in this country with a huge growth in our work, partially because people aren't accessing the food stamp program, or the food stamp program needs fixing policy-wise.
Well, let's go to the policy guy, Doug O'Brien. We're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, the question is going to be, what can we do for the future to feed the hungry, of which we're feeding 25.3 million every day, thanks to the efforts of the staff and volunteers of the Second Harvest Food Bank. Do stay tuned, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1980. Right back. Well, hunger is among us. What do we do about it? Doug O'Brien, you're the Vice President of Public Policy for America's Second Harvest Food Bank. But beyond that, you've been involved with agriculture for a long time. You're, I guess, what one would call a policy wonk, right?
Yeah, I got it.
What do we do?
Well, I mean,
not only to feed the hungry, but to end hunger.
Yeah, Willie and Lee are completely correct. Is that the future is, I think, a hunger-free America is very possible. And the good thing to think about is it's not just charities that have to carry this load. Lee mentioned before the break the food stamp program. Right now in California, less than half of all the people who are eligible for food stamps participate. And USDA estimates that if even 5% there's a 5% increase in food stamp participation in California. It would generate about $250 million in new economic activity. And as Willie mentioned, is that for a competitive global workforce, we really can't afford to lose kids to hunger, because hunger in the end does cause poverty. A third of the people we serve do not have even a high school level education. That's twice the national rate. And these are people who therefore will never benefit from jobs in Silicon Valley or engineering jobs. They're simply not going to be able to.
Well, not only will they not earn us money, they'll cost us money.
That's precisely correct, to the point of the two earlier callers. So, you know, to solve the problem, one, we need to continue to strengthen the charitable system, because we are the last line of defense against hunger in many families and in many communities. But we also need to make the food stamp program, the school lunch and school breakfast program, the after-school feeding programs, the WIC program, stronger. And fortunately for all of us is that that's generally viewed in a bipartisan way.
Yeah.
President Bush has put additional money. Some 8 million new people were added to the food stamp rolls just in the last 6 years. So, I mean, it's not viewed as either a Democratic or Republican issue. In a bipartisan way, Congress tries to address the problem. And for the first time, you really have a very broad coalition that includes agriculture, including the Western growers and others,
mm-hmm.
Pressing to have a stronger nutrition safety net, because they really just don't want to leave any kid behind.
So, and to end this program, we'll leave with this thought, either feed the hungry or pay the consequences, right? Thanks,
too.
Yeah, Willie Elliott, McCray, Lee Mercer, Doug O'Brien from Second Harvest Food Bank, and thank you out there for tuning in. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on The Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.